Welcome, everyone, to the 10th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, James Doty will be teaching on the power of compassion to change lives. He's broadcasting live from Mountain View, California, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to Dr. James Doty. James R. Doty, M.D., is a professor in the neurosurgery department at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's also the founder and director of the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, also known as CCARE, of which His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the founding benefactor. James is also the author of Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. Welcome, James.
Well, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be with you today.
We're honored to have you with us. Thank you.
As you said, today I'm going to discuss, if you will, the power of compassion to change lives. And I'm going to divide that into six different parts, which hopefully by the end of our conversation will all make sense and actually give your listeners an understanding whereby they can actually utilize what we've spoken about to change their own lives. The first thing that I'd like to discuss today is really giving an overview of why it is that our species in particular has developed these nurturing and caring pathways. There are basically two types of selection when we talk about evolution of species. One is called R selection, and this is typically associated with fish and reptiles, such that based on the fact that they have immediate threat oftentimes when they're born, they have evolved such that they immediately swim off or run off to protect themselves and do not require any interaction, actually, with their mothers or parents, if you will. The human species and many mammalian species, but particularly the human species, it's a much different story, and this is called something called K selection. And particularly for humans, it is very important if we are to survive that we get quote unquote educated, if you will, by our parents and particularly our mother. And the reality is that our offspring, in fact, require 10 to 15 years of interaction with their parents before they are actually able to survive in what is a very harsh environment, at least certainly in regard to, let's say, the savanna in Africa, where our species originated. As a result of that requirement, that our offspring are cared for or nurtured, if you will, we have developed pathways which motivate us to care. Because, in fact, maternal nurturing and bonding requires an immense amount of energy and resources. And our offspring, again, by the manner in which we have evolved as a species, require that they learn from us in a very direct way through interaction and modeling, if you will, and this is commonly referred to as the mirror neuron system. So in regard to the expenditure of resources from the parent, we have developed pathways whereby when we care, when we nurture, particularly with our offspring, we are rewarded. And many of our listeners have heard, I'm sure, of oxytocin, which is commonly called the love or nurturing hormone. And there are other hormones. And when a mother cares for her child, or if you will, responds with compassion, and the definition that we use of compassion is the recognition of another's suffering with a motivational desire to intervene. When a mother sees that her offspring is suffering and intervenes and cares for and protects her offspring and alleviates that suffering, she is rewarded with oxytocin and other neurotransmitters through the nurturing or caring pathways. And these are associated with our reward system and our pleasure system. So in fact, when a mother cares for her child or relieves suffering or pain, she is rewarded. And the other aspect of this is that we are, as a species, finely attuned to recognizing suffering. And we are tuned through the recognition of microfacial expressions, body language, and even smell. And as an example, I think all of us realize that when our partner walks into a room, they don't have to say anything. And we know oftentimes immediately how they feel. And this is a holdover, of course, from those same pathways, this ability to instantaneously be attuned to another individual, and certainly especially to an individual who is closely connected to us. Now, remember, our DNA has actually not significantly changed for the last 200,000 years at least. And in fact, as we evolve from the nuclear family to the hunter-gatherer tribes of 10 to 50, which was our primary survival strategy until 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, these same pathways are at play. If a member of this tribe was in pain, was suffering, their inability to do the tasks assigned to them by the tribe could put the tribe at risk. And again, it was very, very important that we recognized when another of our tribe was in pain or suffering. And again, you can see the evolutionary necessity of reinforcing this pathway. And then, of course, as you look to how we further evolved as a species, with the domestication of animals and plants, which gave us more time, this is what allowed us to create culture, religion, society. And at the core of each of these is, again, the necessity to care, to cooperate. If a society or religion, if you will, is to function effectively and to grow. So it's not a surprise that essentially everything that is associated with the positive aspects of our survival really come down to this aspect of compassion, caring, nurturing. Now, before I leave this topic, though, I have to also comment on two other aspects of our evolution, which actually also are with us, and that, in fact, can interfere with our ability to be compassionate or to care. One of these, excuse me, which I've already alluded to, is this tribal mechanism. In our evolution, we formed these groups of 10 to 50, and they provided protection for the group. And this is why when you are in a group of people who you feel safe with, oftentimes these are people who look like you, who act like you, who think like you, who are often of the same color, same culture, same religion, or have other attributes that connect you. And it's this connection to these others that make one feel safe. And certainly in primitive societies, that is the case. But in fact, though, we know that this tendency to connect with tribes, if you will, or groups that have common interests nowadays can actually be detrimental. Because in a global society, in a society that's connected in all the ways we all know through the internet, through the ability to call anytime, anywhere around the world, the ability to see via television or other means of media to connect with what's happening in the world, we in fact are now connected like we have never been. And this actually can be an advantage if you see that you're part of a whole, that all of us are one, but it can also be a huge disadvantage if you see yourself as completely different from another and are frightened by that difference. And if you look at the work of individuals such as David DeStenno and others, being able to break this barrier down in regard to what separates us can decrease this feeling of threat oftentimes from others who are not like us. The other aspect, which will lead into the second part of our conversation, is the fact that our vagus nerve, which is this myelinated part of the autonomic nervous system, and which is divided into two parts, the sympathetic nervous system, which many of us know as the flight, fight, or freeze response, and the parasympathetic nervous system, which is known oftentimes as the rest and digest system, are very much intertwined with what I alluded to in terms of threat. Because it's threat that oftentimes has motivated people to come together, and oftentimes results in conflict. And this threat can be real, or in fact, it can be artificial. So the vagus nerve is not only represented in the heart, and it arises in the brainstem, but it is also associated with a variety of other organs in the body. And it's a two-way communication. But let's get back to threat and what it does. On the savanna in Africa, we did not have too many demands on each of us. We had to find food. We had to find shelter, water. And if we saw a threat, as an example, if we saw the grass move a distance away and knew that that often represented a, let's say, a lion, then our sympathetic or flight or fright system would kick in. And this worked great in the context that there would be this massive release of neurotransmitters that would increase your heart rate, increase your blood pressure, divert blood from your organs of digestion, as an example, to your skeletal muscle to allow you to run. And it would also result in dilation of your pupils and your mouth getting dry, if you will. And it allowed you to run away, to remove yourself from this threat. And certainly that was a critical part of our survival. But unfortunately, we have the same threat mechanism as of 200,000 years ago. And in modern society, oftentimes we are triggered to believe that there is threat by the nature of our evolution and this part of our vagus nerve, known as the sympathetic nervous system, that then results in a stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system far beyond what is necessary. As an example, we are constantly deluged with inputs, whether it's a cell phone, whether it's a TV, whether it's a radio, also whether it's other people. And we oftentimes are in positions, even at our work, where many different things are bombarding us all the time. And what happens for many people is that they have the constant release of these hormones that are released when the sympathetic nervous system is engaged, which on a chronic basis are extraordinarily deleterious to our health. And in fact, as an example, in Silicon Valley here, we have an epidemic of anxiety, stress, and depression. And it's not just in Silicon Valley. In fact, it's in the Western world. And that is because of this overload of our ability to react to all the data that's coming into us at one time. And when you have the constant release of these threat hormones, it has an effect on chronically elevating your blood pressure, resulting in your heart rate variability being decreased, which is associated with sudden cardiac death. It results in your immune system being depressed, and it results in the release through the development or production of inflammatory proteins that result in, if you will, a lot of negative effects on your organs of your body, such as your kidneys, your heart, your peripheral vascular system, and then ultimately has an effect on the length of your telomeres. And your telomeres are those parts of your genes at the end that are associated with longevity. And in fact, there is a wonderful book that has recently been released called The Telomere Effect by Alyssa Eppel and Liz Blackburn, the Nobel laureate, which actually, if you're interested, you can read because it talks about many aspects of this. So what happens is when you are presented with threat, as an example, your brain has to process this. First of all, you have to decide if in fact something is a threat. Or we also have a system, if you will, of disgust if we see something which would, as an example, with spoiled food, would stop us from eating it. Or if we, as I mentioned earlier, threat being either a person, an animal, or a situation that causes us fear or uncertainty about what is going to happen. And this is mediated through our amygdala, which is basically our threat system. And it connects with other parts of the brain, parts that release hormones, if you will, those associated with threat response, as I mentioned, epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol, and also is associated with memory because threat, whether it is real or artificial, is mitigated or stimulated by memories one has of past threats or past situations which engage the threat response. And then from there, the individual actually makes a decision of how they are going to respond to that threat. And in fact, as one is doing so, one sees an increase in metabolism, not only in the amygdala or this place where a threat is processed, but also in your premotor cortex. And this is the area of the brain that is associated with you making a decision in terms of motor function, as an example, to run away. And so there's actually a pathway you can follow in the brain utilizing tools of neuroscience, such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, which demonstrates areas of increasing metabolism when one is threatened. And then this leads to what I had previously described as what happens. Once you have perceived something as a threat, then this input now becomes an output. And this is the two-way nature of the vagus nerve. And that output is a shutting down of the gastrointestinal tract and the diversion of blood to the skeletal muscle, the release of epinephrine and norepinephrine, which increase contractibility of the heart and also results in the muscles receiving more blood, your pupils dilating so that you can see with more clarity, and as a result, gives you your best self, if you will, to avoid threat. And in some people, their threshold for having their autonomic nervous system sympathetic component engaged has become very, very low. And in fact, in some ways, it results in them essentially not being able to function effectively in modern society. Now, the sad part of this is that instead of addressing the underlying issues which may cause this type of threat, we are now using pharmaceuticals, which, while they may mask the problem in some ways and allow one to function, they don't deal with the underlying issue, which is how does one regulate their input and output from the vagus nerve? Because what we do know is that when you are able to increase your vagal tone and stimulate your parasympathetic nervous system, or this rest and digest system, that there is an increase in heart rate variability. There is a lowering of the blood pressure. There is stimulation of the gastrointestinal tract. Your sphincters relax. And you feel a sense of safeness and connection. And in fact, when one can stay in this mode, if you will, and really this is the mode in which we were designed to function at our best, many amazing things happen. One is you were healthier. Two is that this area of your brain, which is called the frontal executive control area, works better. And in fact, works at its best. And the frontal executive control area is this part of our brain that allows us to be much more discerning and thoughtful about decision making. And it can be thought of as sort of a slower mechanism to make decisions versus that associated with the sympathetic nervous system engagement, whereby it is a much faster reactionary mechanism of decision making, which allows you to respond immediately to threat. It may not be the best decision making, but it is one which allows immediate removal of yourself from what you perceive as a threatful situation. The other aspect of this is that when your parasympathetic nervous system is engaged, your ability to be creative and more thoughtful is maximized. And in fact, your productivity is increased. And we'll talk about how engaging your parasympathetic nervous system can really benefit you, not only in interaction with others, but also in all of your activities. What I'd like to talk to you a bit now about is how, in fact, we are learning that, one, there is a genetic component to one's ability to be compassionate and engage this parasympathetic nervous system, which allows you to feel safe, which allows you to feel connected, which allows you to accept nurturing and allows you to give nurturing. But in fact, there is a significant environmental component. And what that means is that each of us has the capacity to increase our ability to be compassionate and receive the associated health benefits. Interestingly, if you look at other mammals and also the human species, we have found that, let's say, in a particular type of rodent, there have actually been documented receptor anomalies in regard to oxytocin. And there's one particular type of rodent called a vole, in which one particular species, which has a certain type of oxytocin receptor, is monogamous, and let's say much more family or socially connected, while there's another that has a different type of receptor. And in that instance, the male does not have monogamous relationships, but in fact has numerous partners and is not connected at all for any extended period with the partner. And we, in fact, see this in the human species. There's also different types of oxytocin receptors, but there are also other aspects of these neural pathways that are genetically expressed and potentially interfere with one's ability to connect with another. And autism may be an example in which one has the inability, or at least limited ability, to understand facial expressions or other aspects of another individual such that they can respond appropriately. But in regard to the ability to potentiate one's own compassion, there's a lot of work that has been done both by our group and Seek Care, as well as a variety of other individuals. And it's interesting that these techniques, if you will, for mind training are having a variety of effects, very positive effects, in different domains. Certainly, in regard to the individual, we know that these types of techniques can dramatically result in improvement in just social interaction in one's family and affect positively relationships that individuals have. But we can also look at other domains of life. As an example, in the educational environment, there's an increasing body of evidence to imply that the ability to train children can increase their ability to connect, increase their ability to be empathetic. And what that means is to take on the emotional state of another and appreciate that they might be suffering and understand, by taking on that individual's emotional state, what it feels like to be suffering, and therefore want to alleviate that suffering. And we've seen that when that occurs, not only is there a decrease in violence or bullying, but in fact, there is an increase in attendance and an increase in academic performance. Now, I won't say that this data is strong at this point, but certainly there are a lot of indicators that this could have a profound effect in these types of educational environments. And the interesting thing that is noted is that the ability, though, to practice compassion very much so has to do with other aspects of mind training that many of you are probably familiar with, which is commonly termed mindfulness. And of course, this has been brought to the West by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And it is typically described as having two components. One is the ability to attend or to be present. The human species is interesting in that it is the most evolved species that has an ability to remember past events. Of course, we know that elephants do as well, and dolphins, but I believe that most would agree that we are the most evolved in the context of having memories of the past. Now, the other aspect, though, that other mammals do not have is that we also have a perception of a future. And what happens for many, many people, and there have been studies that have been done that have demonstrated it, this, is that for many people, the majority of the time, they are not present because they are lost with memories of regret about a past event. If I could have, might have, if I had done X, Y, or Z, things would have been different. Or anxiety and uncertainty about a future of which they have no control. And what we do know from a variety of studies is that unless you are present and have the ability to attend, this otherwise interferes with your ability to connect with another person. And it's this connection which allows you to understand first that everyone is suffering, but certainly appreciate another situation. And also in regard to even education, being able to get rid of these distractions and be present allows for one to learn much easier. The other aspect of mindfulness is an understanding of the reality that we have an ongoing dialogue in our head. And many times that ongoing dialogue is not one of affirmation or support or of kindness to each of us, but is negative. And when these negative words or this negative dialogue passes by us, if you will, oftentimes we have a negative emotional response to it and a negative physiologic response. When we beat ourselves up, when we're hypercritical, that actually engages the sympathetic nervous system, which, as I've already said, has a very, very negative and deleterious effect on our long-term health. And these are the fundamental aspects of mindfulness. One, the ability to attend or be present. Two, recognizing that there is this ongoing dialogue and not having an emotional or physiologic response to that dialogue, but just the ability to sit with it and observe. But I tell people that there are two other aspects that are critically important if one wants to maximize their physiology, and they are the following. And one person actually characterized this, that you cannot release yourself from a prison unless you understand, in fact, that you are in a prison. If you don't appreciate that you have this dialogue, if you don't appreciate that you have this negative physiologic response, then you cannot escape. And what I mean by that is that we actually, in fact, each of us has the ability to change that dialogue, not just ignore it, not just observe it, but in fact, change that dialogue from one of negativity to one of positivity, from one of hypercriticality to one of affirmation, positive affirmation, to one of, if you will, compassion for self. And many of you may be familiar with the work of Kristen Neff, who's pioneered this concept of self-compassion and how important it is for us in terms of our health even, and how being compassionate with yourself actually dramatically affects your ability to be compassionate to others. Because if you were constantly suffering, if you were constantly beating yourself up, in some ways, this is a selfish preoccupation that actually clouds your ability to see the true nature of reality or to see beyond yourself. And when you're able to love yourself, when you're able to be kind to yourself, it allows you to relax, it allows you to be present, it allows you to attend, and allows you to connect and see others. And this is really, really critically important. And this fourth part, this ability to be compassionate to others, this ability to open your heart, is actually the fundamental aspect of who we are as humans and is fundamentally how we evolved as a species, which is to nurture and to care. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the techniques, some which we've developed at Stanford, others which have developed elsewhere, similar in ways, and all with the goal of increasing our ability to be compassionate to others. At Stanford, we have developed, and I say we, within our group, led by Thupten Jinpa, who many of you know is the primary English translator for His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who has a PhD from Cambridge, and who is recognized as an expert on Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy, and who also has a great understanding of other religious traditions. He, in conjunction with PhD psychologists, spent a few years actually developing the Seek Care Compassion Cultivation Training Program, which has now been validated through a variety of studies in regard to its ability to allow each of us to open our heart. And it is now used in a variety of contexts and situations. It's being used with healthcare workers to decrease their own stress and improve their resilience. It's used in the business environment to decrease stress and anxiety. It's being used in individuals with existential crises, if you will, fear of death, or in individuals who are caregivers for those who are suffering from a variety of disorders. And it's being used in the educational system. And it is an 8-week course that, first of all, gives you the techniques that are typically associated with mindfulness to be present, to attend, an understanding of this dialogue that I was just discussing, this negative self-talk, the ability to be self-compassionate, and then ultimately to be compassionate to others. And what's extraordinary is that when an individual learns to be kind to themselves, when an individual learns to be kind to others, many things physiologically happen. One is when an individual is observed by others, practicing compassion, if you will, it has a rippling effect on those around them. The other thing is, excuse me, is that when one practices compassion, it changes how others interact with you. I tell people, and this is from my own personal experience, when I changed how I saw the world, and at one time I saw many things as a threat, then I responded with fear and, in fact, body language that expressed that fear, or in some instances, anger and hostility. And as a result, individuals responded to me in that way. I tell people, though, that, and this was my own experience again, when I changed how I interacted with the world changed how it interacted with me. And in fact, the fundamental nature of what I learned is really responsible for any success that I've had to date. Excuse me, I'm going to cough again. I'm sorry, I have allergies. And so what we do know now is that when one acts with compassion, with intention, in fact, this is more beneficial to one's health than being at your ideal body weight or exercising. And that's quite amazing. Now, of course, this isn't an excuse not to engage in those activities, but it demonstrates how powerful being compassionate with intention, in fact, can be. Over the last many years, through my own journey, I actually developed a tool which has become my own practice to, if you will, keep me centered as a human being and as a physician. And it was after really a long period of reflection on those things that have occurred in my own life, which have been strengthening to me as a human being. And in the kind introduction I received, there was a mention of a book that I have written called Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to understand the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. And I share that in the book, and it's called The Alphabet of the Heart. And I just want to share that with you and tell you a very quick story. As I was reflecting on my own journey, as I mentioned, I was actually doing this because I was giving a lecture to a group of students who were about to start medical school. And I wanted to give them a tool that would allow them to stay centered throughout their training, but was easy to remember. And as many of you know, in medical school, you have to remember many things. And I came up with a alpha mnemonic, if you will, 10 letters of the alphabet that has now actually become my own personal practice to generate compassion within myself and to stay centered. And the first letter is C, and this is this concept of compassion for self and compassion for others. Second letter is D, recognizing the dignity of every human being, a recognition that none of us are superior to another, and in fact, the only way to truly be compassionate to another human being is to see them as your equal, eye to eye. The third letter is E, and this is this concept of equanimity, or evenness of spirit, or excuse me, evenness of temperament. You could say spirit, I suppose. It's so easy for us, when we have wonderful things happen to us, to gravitate towards them and always want to have that feeling. But the reality is, life is a pendulum in many ways and swings back and forth. And all of us will have some degree of suffering in our lives. The interesting thing is, for most of us, it's not those periods of all of these wonderful things happening to us that actually give us wisdom. It is when we have suffered, when we have experienced deprivation, when we have seen what pain is, that is often the greatest gift we receive in terms of wisdom and also the ability to care for others, because we personally know what it's like to be in pain. And when we empathize with another and feel their own pain, we're much more likely for that to resonate with us and want us to alleviate their suffering. F is for forgiveness. This idea that when we carry anger within us towards another, it actually does nothing towards the other person. It's like drinking poison and somehow thinking that that's going to affect the other person. The only person anger and hostility affects is you. And it also shows you our own biases, because every one of us has actually hurt another person or done an act, frankly, which we're not proud of. G is having gratitude. Just us being together today is a blessing. And in fact, one that the vast majority of people will never experience. Being able to sit here, being able to relax, being able to have a conversation. So many of us, though, look at others who we think have a better situation, a better marriage, or are more financially secure, and think that those individuals are enjoying life more than us. And while that may be true in some instances, oftentimes people who we look to wanting to be like them are actually suffering in their own way, and oftentimes very, very deeply. H is having humility. Again, this idea of recognizing that none of us is more important than another human being, and not carrying this superiority to others and demonstrating that in different situations. Oftentimes we see people who are very proud of how many hours they've meditated or what retreat they've been on and want to demonstrate and tell everyone. And this is the antithesis of introspection. So having humility, just being who you are, accepting it, having gratitude for that, and not having to compare yourself to another. And that's one of the challenges for each of us, because it's a natural tendency that each of us has. I is having integrity and values that you live by, and then you don't deviate from, or at least you try not to. K is kindness, caring for another. And they don't even have to be suffering. Just simply the act of offering yourself, the act of caring, has a very positive effect on our physiology. And finally, all of this contained by love. And there's an interesting story that goes along with this that I would like to share with you in the last few minutes that we have. I received an email from a woman about 2 months after I had given that lecture, and she was the spiritual director of the largest homeless shelter in the United States. She said, "I was burned out from my work. I'm a person of faith, and all of my friends had sent me scripture, and nothing had had an effect on me. And on my last day at work, someone shared with me your talk." And she said, "It proved so powerful for me. It gave me the strength to return to work and has become my practice." And I was so, so moved to tears, in fact. A few months later, she sent me another note indicating she had now actually begun using this practice with individuals at the homeless shelter, and it was also very powerful. A few months later, she sent me another email, and she shared with me the fact that she had told a friend of hers about this practice, and her friend had a daughter who was 9 years old at the time, and who made beads. And as many of you know, and as actually this woman explained to me, and I knew it though, but she kindly explained it to me, was that beads or malas are used in every religion or spiritual practice to be give tools to be centered. And this 9-year-old girl took it upon herself, and she made a set of beads, 10 wooden beads representing each letter, and added herself a golden bead to represent the golden rule: do unto others as you wish done to you, and which has been present for thousands of years in essentially all societies. And a few months after that, and let me say that she had actually asked me if they could sell this as a fundraiser for her homeless shelter, which I, of course, immediately agreed to. But a few months later, she sent me a video she had made because it so profoundly moved her. And it shows this little girl with her hands on a golden cloth, laying out a string and adding these wooden beads and ultimately the golden bead. While this woman, whose name is the Reverend Ann Helmke, narrates, telling something that, in fact, resonates and reemphasizes what we've been talking about, how an individual can create super neural pathways of compassion by repetition and intention. And in fact, this is the fundamental nature of neuroplasticity and how each of us has the ability to change or strengthen neural pathways that each of us have and that have been present oftentimes from the very origin of our species. And if you're interested in learning more about this, in fact, I actually did a podcast, and you can go to my website called intothemagicshop.com under podcast. And there's a podcast that talks about this alphabet of the heart and talks about why each letter was chosen, the science, the neuroscience behind each of those letters and why it was chosen, offering actually references and a practice that one can do beyond what we've spoken about today. And in fact, on that same website is the story about those quote-unquote compassion beads, and in fact, the video that this wonderful woman created. So let me just emphasize a couple things in the last few minutes that we have. One, each of us fundamentally is, by our nature, wired to be kind, compassionate, and to care for others. And in fact, that's when our physiology works its best. In modern society, we get distracted and engage our sympathetic nervous system. But in fact, each of us has the ability to go from, if you will, engagement or downregulation of our vagus nerve to stimulation of our vagus nerve and stimulate our parasympathetic nervous system, which is this rest and digest system, which allows us to be open, to connect, to care. And when we do so, our physiology works at its best. It's when we're most creative. It's when we're most productive. And it's really our default mode. Our brains are made to allow us as a species to be our best when we connect with others. In fact, I'm going to share with you a study that was done to just show you how powerful this is. There was something called the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, and this was a study where they followed women over the age of 65 for a period of time. One group volunteered or cared for others, and the other group did not. And at the end of the study, that group of individuals who cared for others had almost a 2x increase in their life expectancy. Extraordinary. The other study I'd like to quote is the Harvard study, which spanned over 75 years with men. And it showed that the thing that connected them the most is also what offered the greatest degree of happiness and the greatest life expectancy. And again, it's when they had relationships and when they connected. And the final study I'd like to share with you is one that was done at Google. And many of you know, Google's a very successful organization. And at one time, they only hired people who were in the top 5% of their class in a select number of Ivy League and prestigious schools. And they thought that was the key to success in terms of leadership, in terms of productivity, in terms of innovation, in terms of creativity. And do you know what the amazing thing is? They found that there was absolutely no correlation, none. The thing that allowed people in Google to become leaders, the best leaders, are those individuals who are authentic, who show who they really are, that they're suffering, and that connect with other individuals. That was the key to success. And it took Google spending millions and millions of dollars, crunching amazing amounts of data to come to a conclusion that I think you can see was self-evident all along. So thank you for being with me. I hope this was somewhat enlightening. It really has been a pleasure to be with you today. And certainly I'm available to answer any questions regarding what we've just talked about. So please feel free.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We definitely have questions that have come in from some of our participants. And I'd also like to take the opportunity to invite those of you with questions to submit them now. You can do so by entering them into the field just below this video. James, I'd like to take you back to an early story that you shared about your young life and the chaotic environment that you grew up in. You speak of going into that magic shop, literally, and meeting someone who helped you change your life. I'd like to get you to talk a little bit about that and how you managed to hold that grace for yourself when you went back to your home life.
Sure. And this is talked about in the book, which I mentioned a little bit. I grew up in poverty. My father was an alcoholic. We were on public assistance essentially my entire life. My mother had had a stroke. She was partially paralyzed, had a seizure disorder, chronically depressed, attempted suicide many times. And at the age of 12, I was becoming a juvenile delinquent. I was angry. I was shamed. I had hostility. And I also was constantly in fear because I had a very chaotic, dysfunctional environment, and I never knew what was going to happen next. And certainly, this is not a formula for success in life. And at the age of 12, I walked into a magic shop, and the owner was not there, but his mother was there. And she knew nothing about magic in the store, per se. Her son, who owned the store, was running an errand, but she knew about people. And she had this radiant smile that completely engulfed you with love. And it was really quite extraordinary. And after a conversation of about 15 or 20 minutes, she said to me, "I think I can help you. And if you come in here every day for the next 6 weeks, the period which she was going to be there for the summer, I think I can teach you something that could change your life." And in many ways, it's part of the conversation we just had. She taught me really basically what is combined in our Compassion Cultivation Training Program. And at that time, remember, this was 1968, the term neuroplasticity was unheard of. Mindfulness, certainly in the general conversation, was not heard of at all. But this lady, who must have had some background with Eastern philosophy and religion, spent the next 6 weeks teaching me this practice. And what it allowed me to do was to not hold on to this anger and hostility. It taught me that the events that were happening to me were simply events. They didn't have a positive or negative per se, that I gave those events power. And it also made me aware that my parents and others around me were suffering and had their own struggles, and that their behavior was not necessarily directed at me per se. And the extraordinary thing then, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is that when I released my own anger, when I no longer responded with fear and anxiety to events, but just accepted them, everything changed for me. I had no anger towards my parents. I had no anger towards my situation. And in fact, that release was almost a joyous event to me. And because I no longer interacted with those around me with anger and hostility, they no longer responded to me in that way, and that changed everything. And it's really two parts of this. One is changing how we react and seeing how others change in their reaction to us, but really understanding how one person, and it could be you or I or anybody, has the capacity to change the life of another person, regardless of their circumstances.
James, I'm really curious about you as this young 12-year-old boy. What was it in you that knew that there was something useful there that led you to come back for those 6 weeks? Because as you say, you were on the verge of becoming a delinquent. Life was chaotic at home. And here is this strange woman in a magic shop saying, "I don't know anything about magic." It just seemed like there were a lot of reasons for you not to go back, but you did. What was alive in you in that moment to keep you connected to her? And I believe her name was Ruth, if I'm remembering this correctly. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Her name was Ruth. Uh-huh. Well, you know, I've been asked that question many times, and I wish I could tell you that I had this incredible insight and that I knew subconsciously or intuitively that she was going to give me the great gift that she did. But frankly, I had no clue whatsoever. The reality is I had nothing better to do. And secondly, that she gave me cookies. And those were the two reasons that allowed me to show back up. Mm-hmm.
Cookies works for me too. So I get that. I get that piece. Okay. So,
well, you know, it's funny because let me just say, it's funny because people have read the book and I mentioned that the cookies you gave me were Chips Ahoy, and people come by and give me gifts of Chips Ahoy. So anybody who's giving me gifts of Chips Ahoy, don't bring me any more gifts of Chips Ahoy.
I think our participants got that. Okay. I've got some questions here from our participants. This one's from Anne. She writes, please share how you came to change how you interacted with the world. So I guess this is kind of an extension of what we were just talking about in those questions.
Well, let me give you an example. And in some ways, this relates to Viktor Frankl. And if you recall, there's the stimulus, the pause, and the response. And this is in Man's Search for Meaning. And it's really this pause, if you will, where everything occurs for good and for bad. Let me just give you a real quick example. Let's say you're driving along and someone cuts in front of you, which all of us have had happen to us. And sometimes you almost have an accident. And typically we have an absolute immediate response, don't we? Which is, you may use an expletive, you may use a hand gesture, and you're angry that this person cut you off, right? You've had this immediate response to an event. But let me change the scenario to show how each of us has the ability to modulate that and how it changes dramatically when you're a little bit more thoughtful. If I were to tell you that the person who cut you off, his wife was sitting next to him. She was 9 months pregnant. Her water had broken. She was bleeding. And he was trying to get her to the hospital. Would you feel the same way? Would you, in fact, want to help in any way that you could? And my point here is that oftentimes when people come on us aggressively, when they're having a reaction, it oftentimes has nothing to do with us. But the natural response for many people is to have an aggressive response back to them. And it's this ability to have this pause, to reflect, which in many ways relates to all of our conversation, which is the system that you're going to engage in. And this is how we can train ourselves with the techniques I was describing to you. Are you going to have a reactive, fast response engaging your sympathetic nervous system? Or are you going to be more thoughtful and discerning and understand that the person who's coming on to you aggressively, the event that has happened, may not have any relationship to you at all, and there's no reason for you to react aggressively? And this happens to all of us. I've had instances where individuals who naturally are kind people generally come on very aggressively, and immediately my cackles get up and I'm ready to say something. And then I step back a little bit and saying, this isn't normal. What is it about this person's day that has made them react this way? And when you say something, instead of saying, what the heck's wrong with you? You say something like, listen, this isn't normally, what's going on with you? Can I help you? It changes everything. And this is the example of what happened to me. Instead of being scared and reactive all the time, I was able to calm down and sit back and be much more discerning about my reactions to events.
Sarah asks, why do some people, such as sociopaths, have no compassion? And why do you think they never developed it?
Well, we talked about some of the genetic aspects of this. And in fact, there are people who don't have the ability to, if you will, have theory of mind or understand that other people have independent thoughts or have an ability to process that others are suffering. And in fact, there are studies that are demonstrating that children as young as 4 or 5 can now be shown to be psychopaths, in fact, and they have structural anomalies in their brain. And if you look at MRIs of people on death row, certainly a significant number of those individuals also have structural anomalies in their brains. And you could argue that these people, in fact, do not have the ability to process such emotional states or the suffering of another. And then is it really their fault? Now, that's a whole another philosophical discussion here, but it's certainly true that there are people who just do not have the capacity to show love and kindness to others. And there, in that instance, there's really nothing you can do about that.
When you mentioned oxytocin and the bonds created between the mother and child, I wondered what sort of impact does it have on the child in cases of separation? Say, for instance, that child is given up for adoption, and although they're cared for, it's not this quite the same sort of nurturing necessarily.
Well, I certainly think it could be. In the right context, and it might certainly be better than the particular environment they might be going into with their natural mother. But if you interrupt the bonding of a child, there are a whole variety of studies that demonstrate it has a profound, profound negative effect. Those individuals have the earlier onset of disease. They have increased frequency and increased duration and severity of disease. They're much more likely to have chronic illnesses, and their longevity is significantly impacted, all from not receiving adequate bonding as a child.
Anne asks, have studies shown that fathers are also rewarded with oxytocin when they care for infants?
Men are useless.
I didn't say that. Okay.
There's no question that males can have certainly a response to suffering. Now, it's interesting. There are studies that have been shown, as an example, with partners. A woman responds if she observes her husband suffering in a particular way. And it's similar even if she observes a stranger being affected, given a painful stimulus. So the mother responds similarly. A male does respond to, let's say, observing his spouse or wife having pain inflicted upon her, but for someone else, they don't have the same response. So I would suggest that for their kin, if you will, they probably have a similar response, but not necessarily for others, while a mother has a response oftentimes for everyone.
Zoe writes, I'm an introvert, and I need quite a bit of time out and solitude from connection with others to soften and relax. How does this fit the emphasis on connecting with others for well-being?
Well, connection can mean many things, and it can be different for different people, as you point out. Introverts oftentimes don't process this connection, obviously, in the same way as an extrovert. And in fact, it may be overwhelming and exhausting. What many people, the average person might say, would be an interaction. And that is the nature of our differences. But the fact that they have a different schedule, if you will, in terms of what they're able to tolerate in terms of connection, doesn't mean that their connections are any less strong than an extrovert. They're just different. And that's a far cry away from, let's say, our example of a sociopath or another individual who does not have the ability to connect. It's just a different way to connect.
We have a question from Takia, who writes, does the process of coping or coping grief for people who have connected with others differ from those individuals who never had the opportunity to care for others and grow with them? Besides the obvious tangential possibility of having a larger support network, are there major differences in processing major loss?
Well, I think in some ways this could go back to the introvert versus extrovert question. Everyone has different ways in which to express these types of responses. Certainly, I think if one has grown up in an environment of, let's say, a large nuclear family with many relatives and is used to having deep connection with a variety of individuals, and then those individuals suffer losses, or let's say they lose different members of their families, they may have a response that is mitigated by their connections to others who are serving as a support system. And when someone, let's say, has a limited number of familial connections or relatives, and they don't have strong relationships with others, the loss of someone can actually be overwhelming. And if they don't have a support system to nurture them and help them get through that, certainly, I think it could be much more difficult.
You know, James, I was really struck by the news that being compassionate has as much or more benefit to our physiology than some forms of exercise does. Can you say a little bit more about that and how we can cultivate that growing sense of compassion for ourselves and others?
Sure. It really relates to this ability to increase your vagal tone and stimulate your parasympathetic nervous system. And that's really where it all lies. And in fact, I briefly mentioned this concept of heart rate variability, which in some ways is a surrogate of measuring one's compassionate intention. When one acts compassionately, it results in their heart rate variability increasing, and this is the interbeat difference. And we know that when one is compassionate, there is a significant decrease in their risk for sudden cardiac death. We know that when the parasympathetic nervous system is engaged, the release of cortisol is decreased to baseline levels versus the chronic release of cortisol in a person who has stress and anxiety. And again, it gets back to, in some ways, we talked about the effect of lack of attachment. When your sympathetic nervous system is chronically engaged, in some ways, it is resulting in the same effects as one who does not have adequate bonding. And in fact, we know that when individuals are connected with others, when they have strong relationships, it engages their parasympathetic nervous system. So it's not surprising to note that they are healthier overall. In fact, this in some ways relates to this idea of blue zones. And I don't know if you're aware of these, but these are these areas in the world where people routinely live over 100. And the common denominator in all of these societies are typically small groups who've known each other for their whole lives. There's community and a general sense of love to those in the community and acceptance of who they are, even with warts and everything. And again, all of us have warts and failings, yet they're still accepted and loved. And some of these environments, they smoke, they drink, they eat high cholesterol, and they're still living a long time. And it's really, again, the fundamental aspect, and this is what this Google study showed, is authenticity, connection, and community.
Now, I'm curious about that because in lots of metro areas, I'm here in Colorado, in Denver, Boulder, particularly, just because I have experience with that, I notice that most of the people I meet are from somewhere else. So I wonder if you could speak to how we might build our own blue zones in places that we're not necessarily from and where we might not actively engage with people in our communities. How can we create those zones for ourselves?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, as you know, in modern society, unlike these blue zones, where people live, let's say, multi-generational families, so they live with their siblings as well, their siblings are in close proximity. We, in the modern world, oftentimes live far distant from our parents, our siblings, and others who we may have grown up with. And as a result, we carry with us this anxiety about being judged. And as a result, we carry this shield whereby we present ourselves to others saying, you know, I'm this, I'm that, I have this accomplishment, I'm successful, you know, I'm not suffering, I don't have problems. And the thing is, when you present yourself to others like that who you were just meeting, you're trying to do it to protect yourself, but it also interferes with you connecting with another person because then they feel the same responsibility or desire to present their best selves. And though that interaction does not allow for authentic connection versus saying, you know, I'm really in pain today, I'm having a problem, can I share that with you because I just like your advice because I'm suffering. And, you know, sometimes when I give lectures, my voice will crack or I'll actually shed tears. And as soon as I do that, that gives permission for everyone in the room to cry, right? And I have not had a single person my entire life when I have shown my true self or that I'm in pain or suffering or emotional criticize me. In fact, most people want to come up and hug you. And what I would suggest is, one, you find something, a common ground or some common event or habit or hobby or something that allows you to connect with others. And then you get in proximity to people who have similar interests and you also share who you really are, not who you want people to think you are. And when you do that, that creates a community of trust, of inclusion, and it motivates people, if you will, to be their best selves, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You know, I saw you give a talk and you mentioned your entrance exam and how you wouldn't leave until the administrator let you through the door. And that really touched my heart in that moment. So thank you for that point of connection there. Could you say a little bit about that to our viewers, about what that experience meant to you?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the requirements to function in modern society really don't have any basis in fact. And the what you were alluding to was the fact in my own life where I'd had a very difficult background. I had had to leave college multiple times to deal with family difficulties. And as a result, when I applied to medical school, I had a 2.53 grade point average, and the average grade point average for acceptance to medical school was 3.79. And we had a pre-med committee that you were required to be interviewed by and receive a letter of recommendation. And when I went to ask for my interview, the secretary informed me that she would not give me an interview because to do so would be a waste of everyone's time. And you can only imagine how someone telling you that, how horribly painful that is. But fortunately, because of what Ruth had taught me, in fact, and a sense of self, I was able to look at this woman and say, well, I appreciate what you're saying and acknowledge it. I refuse to accept it. And until you give me an appointment, I'm not leaving. And she did give me an appointment, and I was ultimately scheduled. And I walked into a room with three individuals sitting with their arms folded with my file in front of them, who also informed me that they wished to get the interview over with because it was a waste of everyone's time. And I forced them to look at me not as a number, but as a human being. In fact, I said to them, who gave you the right to destroy people's dreams? Who gave you the right to judge me based on a grade point average and not the totality of my life and who I am? And to take the easy way out. And I ended up lecturing them for about 45 minutes. And at the end of it, they were all crying. And they gave me the highest letter of recommendation. And the point is to have enough self-assurance, to have enough belief in your own humanity, that you refuse to allow others to discard you. And I think this is a critical point. And, you know, you look at our prison system where people are beaten down, and I tell people, the majority of people in prison are not bad people at all. They're people who've not had love and nourishment and nurturing in their lives. And each of them has the right to have their dignity preserved and not taken away. Because when you're able to maintain your dignity, this spark, which really defines our humanity, can actually turn into a flame that'll light the world.
Mm. Yeah, thank you for that. That was beautiful. We have time for one more question from Patty, who writes, what are some tools we can carry, flashlights to turn on, to help us see our way, creating a first bridge back to parasympathetic rest and digest states when life circumstances trigger a stress response and there's no tiger to run from?
Well, sometimes that is the case, and this gets back to the stimulus and response. And all of us have the opportunity to decide what our response is. And what I do in those situations where I'm suddenly engaged in that type of incredibly stressful response is to simply sit back and process for a moment. Most of these situations are not us running from a lion, where that response to run away immediately is appropriate. And being able to pause, that's when everything will change. And it's learning how to be able to pause and not be afraid of pause. And I think all of us have that ability. The exercises which I mentioned, this compassion cultivation training program, which we offer at Stanford and actually have many teachers around the country. If actually you look in my book, I go through what I call Ruth's Four Tricks. And in fact, on the website, intothemagicshop.com, I actually have a guided meditation related to that. And in fact, simply the alphabet of the heart and the compassion beads, I actually use that as a practice every morning where I go through those letters and I sit with it every morning. And then actually I carry a set of those beads in my pocket. And throughout the day, when I'm particularly stressed, I simply touch them and think of a letter and pause for a moment. Or if I'm suddenly approached with some event, I just put my hands in my pocket and touch them. And that actually reminds me to utilize that pause before I make a decision.
James, thank you so very much for sharing this tremendous insight, these tools and lights and flashlights and flames of inspiration.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really a joy to be with you. And thank you to all of the listeners. It's really a wonderful joy to be able to share with you today. And if any of you have any questions, feel free to drop me an email at jrdoty@stanford.edu. Many blessings to each of you.
Thank you so much. This concludes the 10th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Our gratitude once again for Dr. James Doty for this outstanding presentation. Please note, the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. If you so wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. We'd also like to thank once again everyone who joined us tonight. We really appreciate your participation, the questions you submitted, and all the ones that we weren't able to get to as well. We thank you so much for sending those. Please join us for our next live session with Catherine Pittman. And that'll take place tomorrow, March 25th, 2017 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey.